Good afternoon and welcome to the second half of the special session of the California Supreme Court in Redding. The clerk will call this afternoon's calendar.
The calendar for the Supreme Court of California holding oral argument in special session in Redding, California on Wednesday, October 5th, 2005 at 2 p.m. is as follows. Case number S118561, Ray Kinsman et al., plaintiff and respondents v. Unical Corporation, defendant and appellant. For the respondent, Mr. Smith.
Ready, Your Honor.
And for the appellant, Mr. Norris.
Ready, Your Honor.
Case number S117590, Barrett American Incorporated, plaintiff and appellant v. City of Rancho Cucamonga, defendant and respondent. For the appellant, Mr. McNeil. And Mr. Lanferman for AMICA, California Building Industry Association. For the respondent, Mr. Kim. And Mr. Dunn, amicus curiae for the California Cities and California Association of Counties.
Fritz.
We'll proceed initially in the matter of Ray Kinsman versus Unical Corporation, and we're very pleased to have with us sitting by assignment the Honorable Dennis A. Cornell, Associate Justice of the Fifth Appellate District, sitting by assignment as a Justice Pro Tem of the Supreme Court. We'll hear first from Mr. Smith.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. We ask you to consider two reasons for affirming the judgment. The first reason, which I'll go into in some detail, is that this is not a Privette-type case. And I will go through the factors that make a case a Privette-type case. This is not such a case. And because of that, the premises liability instruction was correct and proper. The second reason is that if you decide this is a Privette-type case, under your most recent statement of that rule in McCune, which is the affirmative contribution rule, it's undisputed that Unical made an affirmative contribution to this hazard by installing asbestos that it knew to be hazardous, by directing people to disturb it, by directing Mr. Kinsman to work in the area where he would be exposed to the asbestos, and by failing to warn and to protect him. Those four acts, we submit, constitute an affirmative contribution. We also ask you to affirm the judgment because you've really been given no viable alternative. The defense position, as I understand it, is that if a landowner decides to install a poison on his property and invite people in to work with it and around it, that landowner has no liability so long as that work is done by contractors. That is an untenable result.
What if the contractors independently know or have reason to know or reasonably could discover that there was this hazard on the property? Doesn't that change the circumstance?
Well, Your Honor, yes, in a narrow set of circumstances. We would acknowledge that if Unical had hired an asbestos abatement company to abate the asbestos risk, Unical would have discharged its duty by hiring someone with equal or greater knowledge of the risk. That did not happen in this case. We do not reach that issue here. We also do not reach the issue of insulators who were dealing with asbestos, but in the mid-50s may well not have known that the insulation contained asbestos or that it was hazardous. But what we are dealing with is a company that admitted that it knew of the hazard.
Mr. Smith, just to follow up on the question that Justice Moreno asked, and your response was, well, only if Unical had hired an asbestos abatement company. And I just want to clarify, I would like to hear from you whether that is the only circumstance, or whether it is sufficient, as one could reasonably argue, that if here the contractor was well aware of the existence of reports that showed the danger of asbestos, to follow up on the question that Justice Moreno asked, I think then there is a different situation. And I don't think it's limited only to UNOCAL hiring, as you presented to the court, an abatement company with superior knowledge of what to do with asbestos.
Well, Your Honor, if this were a case in which the evidence either proved or directly or circumstantially that the a contractor, and we don't have a contractor here, we don't know who was working with the asbestos directly. It could have been UNICAL employees. But this record does not show the premise of your hypothetical. It does not show that either Kinsman or his employer, Burke and Reynolds, knew or had reason to know of the asbestos or its hazard. In fact, defense counsel for UNICAL in closing argument admitted maybe they didn't know. He acknowledged that my clients did not know and the employer did not know. Bear in mind, my client is a carpenter, not an insulator. His company was hired for this job to erect and dismantle scaffolds. And he worked, as defense counsel acknowledged to the jury in closing argument, he worked with hammers and nails, not with insulation. So there's no basis for my colleagues, as they suggest in their papers, to infer that Mr. Kinsman or his employer knew or had reason.
My inquiry was directed to the possibility of remanding the case. As we all know here, the jury did find UNICAL negligent under a theory of premises liability, and must have implicitly found that UNICAL knew or should have known of the hazards of asbestos
yes.
dust on the property.
That was admitted.
But the jury made no finding whether your client's employer, the contractor, had any knowledge of the hazard or should have known of the hazard. Assuming that, wouldn't this court have to remand for a determination on that particular issue?
No, Your Honor, because that's a question of fact. And if UNICAL had wanted to put on evidence to support that conclusion, they could have done so. They did not. If they had wanted the jury to reach such a finding, they could have asked for a verdict that included that finding. They did not. If they had wanted instructions to support that finding, they could have asked for those. They did not. The point you have just raised and articulated very clearly has been waived.
How do the instructions that were given bear upon this issue?
There was the there was an instruction, or let me put it this way. I don't recall the instruction, but an apportionment was allowed. But the only apportionment of fault that was claimed by defense counsel in closing argument was to apportion to the suppliers of asbestos and the manufacturers. And he said they should be 90% responsible because of their superior knowledge about the hazard. That's the only entity in closing argument that UNICAL asked for fault to be apportioned to. Now, I would also add that the knowledge that UNICAL had came from oil industry documents. The 1937 Bonsiv report was authored by a scientist at Standard Oil of New Jersey in 1937. And that was the basis on which we said to the jury, and the jury agreed, in the oil industry, you know of the problems of asbestos dust. And a defense counsel admitted that this document could well be in their library. And he also admitted, do we know of the hazard? Of course. That's his language in closing argument. Of course, we knew of the hazard. So he said, when you have doctors and scientists, I'm paraphrasing, but I think he mentioned those two words in closing argument, when you have doctors and scientists on your staff, of course you know. Now, that immediately distinguishes UNICAL from Burke and Reynolds. They're a scaffolding company. They don't need to have doctors and scientists on their staff, and they don't know of this document. They're not in the chain of distribution. They're not part of the American Petroleum Institute. They don't have people who circulate in that area. So, again, I would say the premise of Justice Kennard's question, if it had been a fact they had wanted to prove, and I don't believe they could have, they should have done it at trial. It's not proper for this court to remand a case for further investigation of a question of fact.
Mr. Smith, would you agree that there are two conflicting policies presented by the facts of this case, one being holding a negligent wrongdoer accountable and the other not allowing an injured person to recover twice for the same injury?
No,
how do you reconcile those if you agree that those are two conflicting policies?
Well, it occurs in our law, and we tolerate it, that people who collect workers' compensation can recover against third parties.
But that presents the problem here, is if your client had worked for UNICAL, he would be limited to his workers' comp recovery.
That is true, and that is has never been a reason to preclude a client who is a worker who's in my client's situation from recovering against third parties. That may be an anomaly, but it's an inequity that we tolerate because it's something that an employee knows going in. You cannot recover against your employer. Here we are not seeking recovery from our employer. We're seeking recovery from the third party who knowingly installed asbestos, knowing of the hazard, knowing that it would have to be disturbed. Asbestos is not eternal. It requires replenishment and replacement periodically, and that's what Charlie I talked about in his testimony in detail. UNICAL knew there would come a day when that would happen, and they knew that by directing Mr. Jerry, whatever his last name was, of UNICAL, directed my client to say, put your scaffold here.
So you're saying the policy of making the wrongdoer responsible should prevail over the policy of windfall recovery?
Your Honor, if I'm driving for FedEx and somebody runs into me, I get compensation from FedEx, workers' compensation, and I get a tort recovery from the third party. That is not considered a windfall in our system.
What if it's another FedEx truck that runs into you?
Well, that would be a different circumstance, and that's not our case. That's not our case.
Well, Mr. Smith, under your construction here, you believe that the jury instructions that were given were adequate?
Yes, my first point is the premises liability instruction, which no one's ever challenged as being an adequate statement of that rule, was proper. And it covers the field.
Would this make UNICAL liable even if the hazard wasn't concealed?
No, it would not.
Why is that?
I'm about to get the instruction so I can answer your question. I'm referring to page 15 of the Court of Appeal opinion as a slip to our petition for review. The elements are three, or there are two elements with a liability consequence. If UNICAL should have foreseen that a person such as Plaintiff Ray Kinsman would be exposed to an unreasonable risk of harm, then they owed him a duty of care. Now, they could discharge that duty of care. They could have discharged that duty of care by warning him. They could have discharged that duty of care by implementing any of the 10 safety steps that are outlined in the Bonsev report and that their expert acknowledged in his testimony, incidentally. And they could have said, well, here's respirators. Here are masks. We're going to use a wet-down procedure to suppress the dust. We're going to do all these things to keep the asbestos exposure low. We realize, as the doctors later tell us, that mesothelioma is a dose-response disease, so that the greater the exposure, the greater the likelihood of disease. So it follows from that that if they had kept the exposure down to the minimum, as the Bonsev report had outlined, and as steps were taken by other oil refineries, and those are still the steps that are used today, if they had done that, they would have discharged their duty. So I don't believe this instruction automatically means they're liable. It just means we have to look at their conduct. Did they take reasonable steps to minimize or protect against or warn of the risk that they created?
What if they weren't aware of the risk, though?
That's another case. Mm-hmm. That's definitely another case. And I just, on that point, I need to quote for you Unical's attorney. Please look at RT 1377, 1377 lines 3 to 6, in which he said, Unical, quote, knew it was a hazard in the 1950s, close quote. Another quote. He's asking rhetorically, should Unical have known it was hazardous? He answers his question, quote, of course they should have. They probably did. That's at 1394:15-17. So that would be a different case, and that's not the ruling that we're concerned with here today.
And to the extent the independent contractor had knowledge and the landowner or business owner also had knowledge, what would be the obligation on the part of the landowner or business owner?
You're asking if the contractor had knowledge?
Yes, if both the contractor and the landowner or business owner under this doctrine have knowledge, to what extent would there still be liability on behalf of the landowner or business owner? In other words, does there have to be some showing of reliance on the part of the landowner or business owner on the independent contractor having knowledge and therefore the ability to take steps, or is there going to be some form of joint liability, or how do we allocate responsibility?
Thank you, Your Honor. You faced that issue in McEwen, your most recent case. Because in McEwen, where Walmart had encouraged the contractor to use the unsafe forklift that didn't have the extra chain to protect it, there was fault everywhere. There was fault by the employer. There was fault by Mr. McEwen. There was fault by Walmart. And you allowed that verdict to stand with the apportionment because you said, when a hirer, and I'm quoting from 225 of McEwen, when a hirer of an independent contractor by negligently furnishing unsafe equipment to the contractor affirmatively contributes to the injury of an employee of the contractor, the hirer should be liable to the employee for the consequences of the hirer's own negligence. So you allowed the Prop 51 apportionment to be the solution to the issue of, well, what if they both have knowledge? That's how it would be sorted out. And we think that would apply. It doesn't apply to this case.
Because it's quite clear here that the contractor did not have that.
Exactly. And all, if you look at it on a spectrum, yes, all of the knowledge, and I suggest all of the fault, was with Unical, 100%, which is unlike all of your other Prevett cases up to Hooker, in which the responsibility, knowledge, and liability and misconduct of the employer were zero, of the hirer, were zero. The hot tar in Prevett, the falling wall in Toland, the bulldozer that fell over in Camargo, nothing to do with the hirer.
So as I understand your argument, Burke and Reynolds did not have the same knowledge?
Yes, that's the evidence.
And therefore,
there's no evidence that they had any knowledge.
And therefore could not have taken the same steps to protect itself.
Yes. Bear in mind, there's no evidence that they knew that this insulation had asbestos. And there are other insulations with fiberglass. So Unical chose asbestos, but there's no indication that my people knew it was asbestos and no indication that they knew of the hazard. Let me point out that this is the mid-50s, and those of us who work in the asbestos trenches in litigation know that over the course of the century, from about the 30s to the governmental regulation in 72, knowledge was growing. But it started with the most sophisticated and most knowledgeable sources first, people who would read the medical literature, the British reports of illness, the South African reports of illness, the Bonsib report, the reports in the early 40s about mesothelioma. These are things that Standard Oil, for example, who authored the Bonsib report, knew of because they had people on staff to do that. This is not the type of information that a scaffolding contractor in the mid-1950s was aware of. If it had been, my colleague would have, and his predecessor at trial, would have adduced such evidence. And the best they can do, or their amicus can do, is to try to ask you to take judicial notice of documents that were never introduced at trial and that really should not be taken judicial notice of because they go to a disputed fact issue in this case that's not common knowledge. And they didn't prove it that we had any knowledge of it. And that's why this case, again, is opposite from Privet, Toland, Camargo, and Hooker, where all the fault and all the knowledge rested with either the worker or the worker's employer, dealing with the hot tar, dealing with the falling wall, dealing with the bulldozer, how to drive it, whether to retract the outrigger legs in Hooker. That's all the responsibility of the worker or his employer. So this case is exactly opposite in both aspects in terms of hirer knowledge and fault and worker knowledge and fault. Zero in this case for the worker, 100% in this case for the hirer.
Does an objective test...
Pardon me?
Does an objective test or a subjective test apply regarding knowledge?
Well, the test that was given, if this is to your question, the test that was given, which we support, was knew or should have known. And we don't believe that the law has ever countenanced somebody who sticks their head in the sand and says, I refuse to find out what I should know. In fact, the Bonsib report in its preface says, we are submitting this report because it is the duty of industry to protect the employees of oil companies and refineries.
So it's a combination of both, then.
Well, of course, if they actually know, there's liability, and if they reasonably should know, if a reasonable man in their position would have known, there should be liability. And that issue actually, if I can just conclude on this point, does not arise in this case, the distinction that Your Honor is talking about, because as defense counsel admitted, and I just quoted from his statement to the jury, of course they knew. When they have doctors and scientists on staff, of course they knew.
Does that same test apply to the plaintiff?
It would be a valid defense under an apportionment theory, comparative fault, yes. They didn't prove it. They didn't raise it in the pleadings or their answer or the instructions or the verdict form. But in another case, if a company, a hirer, wanted to say, well, you knew or should have known, or your employer knew or should have known, that would be a valid way to reduce their fault, definitely.
Mr. Smith, some further inquiry, and perhaps you can shed clarification on the point. This goes back to the jury instruction that was given earlier. When a question on that issue was addressed to you, you said that here there was absolutely no fault with the instruction. Taking a look at the instruction, one can certainly make the argument, and I think reasonably so, that the instruction does not make clear that the hazard, the danger of asbestos, and the presence of asbestos, et cetera, must have been concealed from the independent contractor that employed your client. What is your response to that?
That's partly correct, but I think it's not wholly correct. And I'll have two answers. First of all, concealment, if you're talking about fraudulent misrepresentation and intentional tort, is not the level of misconduct that this court has required in McEwen. You were willing to accept in McEwen the negligent misconduct of Walmart in furnishing an unsafe or defective piece of equipment.
Wasn't that the case where Walmart, owning the defective forklift, told the contractor, this is the forklift you are going to use?
They did, but they didn't conceal anything. The facts show in McEwen that Mr. McEwen himself looked at that forklift, knew of the defect. They had a discussion about it, as you recite in your opinion, and they decided to proceed anyway. So it was disclosed. I would also suggest this. In the instruction that you speak of, the premises liability instruction, it's implicit that the hazard was concealed, because otherwise there would not be a risk of the worker coming into an unreasonable risk by being exposed to that harm.
When you say implicit, I can see a counter-argument being made that, well, the problem with this particular instruction is that it doesn't make clear that the hazard, which we've been talking about, must have been concealed by Unocal from the independent contractor that employed your client. Yes.
And that is not the law. That's why it doesn't do that.
Oh, really? What is your support then on that? Because that would fill in the gap that I was interested in.
Oh, thank you. I'm
interested in.
Well, let's start. Respond, Mr. Smith, but your time is otherwise up.
I would cite you to Civil Code Section 1714, the reasonable use of property and using due care with respect to your property, and to your Rowland decision, which embodies Civil Code Section 1714, and to your Alcarez versus Vese decision, which is also on a landowner's duty of care. Fraudulent concealment is not a requirement under any of those standards.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Norris, you may argue to the court.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Stephen Norris, Horvitz and Levy, for Defendant Unocal Corporation.
Counsel, on the issue of concealment that Mr. Smith and I have been talking about, now we'd like to hear from you. With respect to the instruction that was given, from your perspective, was there a problem with the instruction because it wasn't clear on telling the jury that the hazard must have been concealed?
Yes, definitely there was a problem with the instruction in that regard, Your Honor.
Would you please speak up, Mr. Norris?
I'm sorry. Yes, there definitely was a problem with the instruction in that regard, in that it did not specifically refer to concealment or misrepresentation or indicate to the jury in any way that what was required was some finding of affirmative contribution on Unocal's part to the plaintiff's injury.
And to follow up on the question that I asked Mr. Smith and to which I got a response. In your view, does the law or would the law require or should the law require that there be concealment of the hazardous condition?
Yes, that's what exactly what this...
So then you disagree with Mr. Smith. I presume the answer was to the contrary. So I presume you can cite law that you think you have on your side that, yes, you need an instruction on concealment.
Yes, yes. This court has so indicated in a footnote in Toland in which it addressed the issue of a pre-existing dangerous condition on the hirer's property.
Does the concealment have to be fraudulent or can it be merely negligent?
This court indicated that it had to be fraudulent concealment so that constructive knowledge should not be sufficient in and of itself to give rise to liability.
And can a negligent concealment ever constitute an affirmative contribution by the owner?
I don't believe under the rule that this court articulated in Toland that negligence would be sufficient if the court is asking whether in a situation in which the plaintiff is arguing that the defendant either knew or should have known of the risk and disclosed it, that wouldn't be sufficient. There has to be knowledge of the risk in order for there to be affirmative contribution, because as this court has held time and again on this issue, even where there's a theory of direct liability that's being asserted by the plaintiff, there has to be some showing of affirmative contribution. So negligence in and of itself should not be sufficient to meet the required showing of affirmative contribution.
If we, assuming this for the purposes of oral argument, of course, if we were to agree with you that here the jury was indeed improperly instructed, then we have to reach the issue, was the error prejudicial? I'd like to hear from you what your response is.
Absolutely, it was prejudicial. In fact, we think the evidence on this point is so clear that there's no evidence showing that UNICAL should have been aware of the risks of asbestos to workers such as carpenters, a trade such as carpenters, that there's no basis for liability at all, and that it's pointless to send the case back for a retrial because UNICAL should be on this record entitled to judgment as a matter of law in its favor.
I think I may not have quite followed the argument. I may have missed something, so just some clarification.
Sure.
Is it your point that UNICAL didn't know way back of the dangers of asbestos?
Well, let's distinguish, Your Honor, between the dangers of asbestos that were known and the dangers that were not known as of the early 1950s, because it's critical. And we've laid it out in detail in our statement of facts as to what was actually known at the time, what the state of the art was then as opposed to what it is now. And at that point, there were definitely studies that indicated that asbestos was hazardous to certain classes of workers. For example, textile workers who'd spent many, many years in that industry, they were exposed to asbestos over a period of many years. And there were studies documenting that as to those workers, who very often were working in closed conditions, not in an open-air refinery, as is the case here, there was definitely evidence, there were studies indicating that as to certain trades, there was a risk. But as of the early 1950s, were there any studies that the plaintiff pointed to that documented the fact that a trade group such as carpenters who were working at an open-air refinery, that they were at risk for asbestos diseases?
Counsel, is there evidence in the record that the degree of exposure to the asbestos led to some of the employees, like Mr. Kinsman, being called snowbirds because they were literally covered in asbestos?
Actually, Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that question. If you look at that testimony, what you'll see that they're referring to is insulators, not carpenters. They're referring to insulators. So there's a huge difference between insulators, whose job it is to work day in and day out handling asbestos products, who have to pound the asbestos blocks into place around the piping, and who work with the ingredients that are used to create the insulation and mixing them up and creating this dust. They're exposed to this day in and day out. Now, certainly as to those types of workers, you could argue that a major oil company would be on notice that they were, because of their prolonged exposure to asbestos in this way, that they would be at risk. But remember, it's a critical distinction. The plaintiff here is not an insulator. The plaintiff, as plaintiff's counsel has pointed out, was a carpenter. And his job was, he was retained to come onto the property to erect scaffolding, which was used by the other workers. And I cannot emphasize enough that as to that trade group, there were no studies that documented that they were at risk. And a plaintiff's own expert conceded that it wasn't until the 1980s that it was learned that carpenters, in fact, were at risk. So perhaps instead of focusing on the facts in this case, we could just back up just a minute, if this would be a good opportune time to do so, and talk about the law generally, because at this point, I guess I'm not certain how the court is going to resolve the issue as to whether or not some form of affirmative contribution is required in a case where the plaintiff is asserting a premises liability theory. And I think we need to step back and consider the broader issue, preliminarily, the broader legal issue, if that's all right with the court.
And apart from the oil company knowing or assumed to have known the dangers of asbestos, is there a requirement under pertinent law that the inquiry doesn't end there, but then goes on to ask, well, how about the contractor? does the contractor have certain knowledge of the dangers of asbestos? I'd like to hear your response to that.
I am in absolute agreement that that is part of the standard, because there are two questions that have to be asked to determine whether there was liability. First of all, did Unical know of the specific risk to Mr. Kinsman as a carpenter? And, you know, it's our position, as I've outlined, that Unical could not reasonably be expected to know of that risk based on the state of the art as of that time.
Suppose we disagree with you there,
right,
given the reports that to which the oil industry was privy. My inquiry is directed to, do we then take a look at what the contractor knew or should have known?
Absolutely. Under standard concealment instructions, you don't look just to whether or not the defendant concealed the fact, i.e. to the defendant's knowledge, but as Your Honor is suggesting, you also have to look at whether or not the plaintiffs, or in this case the contractor, knew or should have known. Now,
well, are those your two questions then? What about the element of concealment? How does that tie in between knowledge on behalf of the employer, knowledge on behalf of the independent contractor? Does there have to be concealment?
Are you asking if there has to be active concealment?
Yes.
Well, certainly it's arguable that in order for there to be affirmative contribution, that there has to be active concealment. But even if the court concludes that that's not the standard and that you're going to look to whether or not there was some duty to disclose, as Justice Kennard was, I believe, suggesting by her question, there's not just the preliminary question or the threshold question of whether Unical knew, but then there's the question whether Burke and Reynolds knew or had access to reports. Because this is the point. If plaintiff is correct in their premise that Unical knew or should have known, then Burke and Reynolds also either knew or should have known. Remember, this went on for a period. Mr. Kinsman was working there for a period of several years. This work was going on for some time. So it wasn't something that wouldn't have been obvious to Burke and Reynolds. I mean, this was a premise of their work, that they were going to be working at this facility where the insulation was being removed and that they were going to be exposed to some asbestos dust. So it was incumbent upon them to check into the state of the art and determine what was known at the time about asbestos and what the risks were regarding asbestos. Now, again, it's our...
Could they have obtained that knowledge easily? Were the reports that to which Unical was privy, were these classified reports, or were these reports that were pretty much available to the public if one wanted to figure out the dangers of asbestos?
They were very much, in terms of what the risks that were known as of that time, they were very well, they were published. These were documented matters, studies done, one of them conducted by a U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Dreesen, which is referred to in our statement of facts. There's another study called the Flesher-Drinker study that's referred to in our statement of facts in 1946, 5 years before the work began. That was a study done by the United States Navy and the U.S. Maritime Commission. So these were matters of public record.
What about the testimony of the plaintiff's expert, Dr. Castleman, to the effect that there were only scattered reports, I believe, up through 1949 and then not much really, even in the 1950s, not really until the 1970s, that there were really, you know, general knowledge in this field.
Well, again, it's undisputed that the Flesher-Drinker study, a survey of 1,000 workers at a naval yard, was conducted in 1946. The standard that was in effect at the time, as far as what a safe level of exposure to asbestos, was 5 million particles per cubic foot. Now, of course, we know now that's a very hazardous standard, but that standard came into effect, was promulgated in 1938, again by Dr. Dreesen.
But who has access to them, to reports such as that, and who has reason to research them if you're not yourself directly involved in the installation, such as Unocal? I mean, was it enough to put carpenters and their independent contracting employees on notice that they should engage in such research when that's just a peripheral aspect of a carpenter's duties?
Well, a peripheral aspect, but the general contractor was aware that that was what their work required, and it's incumbent on an employer to know the risks of the trade. Plaintiffs also conceded, remember, that the risks of asbestos were actually recorded in prominent journals such as JAMA in the 1930s and 1940s. So plaintiffs try to have it both ways on this issue. I think the reality is what was known was well published, was well documented, but it pertained to classes of workers such as textile workers who worked in close contact. So to that extent, it was a matter of public knowledge. It was in the public domain that these were risks to those type of workers.
Do you differentiate between a group of employees or contractor dealing in an area such as insulation, boilerplates, shipyards where they use insulation of that type, and others such as carpenters where, again, it's somewhat peripheral, it's not central to their operations? Or do you think just because something's out there, once somebody has notice of it, everybody is deemed to have access and notice of it?
Well, I think under the concealment standard, Your Honor, the question is whether Unocal had exclusive knowledge or whether it was accessible to Burke and Reynolds. And I think on these facts, it's really undisputed that the information was definitely accessible if Burke and Reynolds had gone looking for it.
So accessibility is the equivalent of should have known, in effect? You're saying just because it's out there, somebody is put on notice and should have known about it, whether it's within their particular sphere of immediate interest or not?
Well, that's the standard under the concealment test, under whether or not a party has a duty to disclose. As I understand the rule, it is that if the defendant knows of the risk and the plaintiff, or in this case the contractor, is not aware of the risk and has no access to information pertaining to that risk, then there's a duty to disclose. But so long as the contractor has access to the information, there can't be concealment under the affirmative contribution standard.
Are there any other facts in the record besides the inferences you mentioned from which a jury could find that Burke and Reynolds knew or should have known of the asbestos risk?
Well, it's...
Other than inferences.
The specific citations are set forth in our statement of facts. The concession by plaintiff's attorney that there were prominent medical journals, for example, and it was well known in the medical community what the risks of asbestos were.
Mr. Norris, it kind of sounds like you're saying that your client shouldn't have been on a standard of known or should have known, but the plaintiff should have been on a standard of known or should have known.
Well, here's the thing. Again, we feel that the information regarding this particular trade group simply wasn't available to anyone as of the early 1950s. But if plaintiff is correct that the information was available to Unocal, then there's no showing that it wasn't also available to Burke and Reynolds. That's how we evaluate the case.
Well, why do you apply the same standard when Unocal was directly involved in its day-to-day operations with hazardous material such as asbestos, whereas, again, with reference to a person's engaged in carpentry, that's somewhat on the periphery of their general operations and knowledge? Why would you apply the same standard? Just as there might be certain hazards that are very well known to persons engaged in carpentry, but might not be well known to an oil company because they're central to the trade of carpentry and not to oil company operation.
Well, on that issue, Your Honor, I believe that this court has spoken to that issue in the Tolan case and held that the hiring company's superior knowledge in itself should not be a basis for liability.
Is this a superior knowledge case, or is this, as Mr. Smith pointed out, I think early in his argument, a premises liability case? Or are the two intertwined?
Well, I think the two, I guess, are intertwined. But to the extent the contention is made that Unocal, in fact, had superior knowledge, this court in Tolan held that that in itself was not sufficient. So ultimately, based upon the cases to date, what is required is some showing of affirmative contribution. And on these facts, it appears there's no evidence that would support a finding of affirmative contribution. There's certainly no evidence that Unocal concealed any facts. There's no evidence that Unocal, for example, concealed the fact that the insulation contained asbestos. And there's no evidence that Unocal concealed any of the risks of asbestos that were known as of the 1950s. And there's no evidence that Unocal misrepresented any facts. And there's no evidence of any other conduct that this court has characterized as constituting affirmative contribution. For example, there's nothing to indicate that Unocal in any way prevented Burke and Reynolds from taking any of the precautions that could have been taken to abate the risks of asbestos.
But your view is that on that last point that you made, that any time there is some kind of access to information about a particular risk, then automatically, for instance here, the contractor is supposed to have known of the risks.
Well, the employer always has a duty to his employees to know the risks of their trade. That's just part and parcel of the employer's duty to the employees. So if the employer's work requires that they erect scaffolding in the presence of asbestos dust, yes, the employer does have a duty to educate themselves on the known risks. Now, unfortunately, I think that the uncontradicted facts are in this case that even if Burke and Reynolds had delved into the subject, there was nothing to indicate that, again, that carpenters as a trade group were at risk.
I'd like to explore the meaning of concealed. Assume the landowner is liable for failure to warn about a concealed hazardous condition. In this case, what was allegedly concealed is not the presence of asbestos, am I right? Everybody knew that asbestos was there, am I correct?
Well, I believe that that's certainly a given. I think the plaintiffs would argue that they didn't even know that asbestos was present.
I see. Well, let's assume that they did, so I can move on to the second
sure.
part. Does concealment embrace failure to warn about known dangers, known from medical articles or whatever? Would that come within the concept of concealing failure affirmatively to notify?
Well, again, it depends on the state of art, what the duty to disclose would be.
Well, failure, to restate it, failure to disclose is equivalent in this context, I ask, to concealing?
A failure to disclose a known risk that was not known to the contractor or to which the contractor didn't have access,
mm-hmm.
Yes, that would be a form of concealment, as I understand the law.
So if your client failed to notify the contractor that asbestos was on the premises and the contractor didn't know that it was, That would be one kind of concealment, hypothetically. Didn't disclose the presence of asbestos.
If, in fact, it was shown that Burke and Reynolds didn't know, but there was no evidence
right.
that Burke and Reynolds didn't know.
Right, this is all hypothetical, I'm trying to get, yes. But say both sides knew that the product was there, but only your client knew that it was hazardous. We're hypothetically saying that. That would also be a concealment if they didn't disclose that. Hypothetically.
Again, if the contractor did not have access to that knowledge, if the hiring party had exclusive knowledge.
So access is important.
Access.
Say the contractor could have read journals if he hadn't been so busy or if he had thought about it, but didn't. But those journals were available.
That's correct.
That would be access, and so he would be charged with equal knowledge.
That's correct. So ultimately, there are several reasons that Unical can't be held liable on the theory that it affirmatively contributed by concealing the risks. Most importantly, Unical shouldn't be held liable based on standards that became known long after the 1950s. Because again, at that time, there was just no knowledge of the risks to workers such as carpenters, such as Mr. Kinsman. And equally important, there's no evidence that Unical had knowledge of any specific risk to carpenters, such as Kinsman, that wasn't available to Burke and Reynolds. So for these reasons, we would ask that at a minimum, the judgment of the trial court be reversed and the case be remanded for a retrial on instructions that inform the jury of the requirement of affirmative contribution. And that's at a minimum, it should be reversed for a retrial, but we believe that if the court looks at the evidence, that the evidence demonstrates that there's no basis for a finding of concealment, misrepresentation, or any other form of affirmative contribution, and that therefore Unical should be entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Norris. Mr. Smith, you may argue in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I feel like I've just been listening from my colleague to 20 minutes of excellent closing argument to a jury. But this is not the place to rehash whether Burke and Reynolds had access to documents, should have known about a risk. The trial court was the place to do that and to put on evidence and to ask for findings and to ask for instructions and to get a verdict on it. So I'd like to close the door on that by saying it's been waived. In a future case, it may well be a valid defense. And under McEwen, where you accepted the fault of the employer as a defense under apportionment, you could say that, and we would agree with that. But that is not this case. Now, is there a heightened standard other than premises liability for disclosure? No, there is not and cannot be. Because I return you to Civil Code Section 1714. This case is unique in the series of cases that started with Privet in that you have a statutory statement of the landowner's duty. And it's not our place today to vary it or certainly not to increase the threshold of liability that the legislature stated. I go back to my Elsner case where you said that when the legislature says that OSHA standards should apply, they apply. And here the legislature put a duty, an affirmative duty, on the landowner to exercise reasonable care in the use in the management of his property so as not to unreasonably expose others to dangers. That is what happened here. Now, there are five or six reasons why you don't need to stray from established premises liability law to engraft an additional requirement. And those reasons all have to do with why this is not a Privet-type case. And the reasons include here that the hirer affirmatively contributed to the risk by installing a poison and causing that poison to be disturbed and telling people to work around that poison. And on the foreseeability point about scaffolders, I want to respectfully disagree. It was foreseeable. Charlie I and his testimony showed that fibers, asbestos fibers, drift. They don't just stay in the area of the insulator. And he said they drifted 500 feet, and when I went to my car, it was looked like my car had been in a snowstorm. And Mr. Kinsman said, when I dismantled the scaffolding, the visible asbestos fell on me. I saw asbestos debris. And the other point I want to make about negligence is this. A private industry group said that 5 million particles per cubic foot should be the standard. And that was true during the 50s, even though it wasn't correct. It had currency. UNICAL violated that standard. The testimony from our expert, Mr. Castleman, was that visible asbestos exceeds 5 million particles per cubic foot. And we had visible asbestos dust on this property. So UNICAL did not conform even to the standard that was abroad. Yes.
How do we determine whether or not there's been concealment? Do we look to reports that are accessible to the industry but are not in the, you know, fully public domain? Is there a basis to require somebody engaged in carpentry as an individual or as an independent contractor employing carpenters to make itself available of matters such as that that might be arguably at the periphery of carpentry as opposed to not being at the periphery of oil company operations?
I think if I were sitting in your chair, the proper disposition of that issue would be to say it's a question of fact to be proven as to what both the hirer knew or should have known, and what the employer and the worker knew or should have known. It's a question of fact. It can't be described for every case with any formula other than that. But it's embraced in the instruction that was given. It's
Tell me, how was it exactly?
The premises instruction said that there's liability if UNICAL should have foreseen that a person such as Kinsman would be exposed to an unreasonable risk of harm. That would necessarily be a harm that he's not aware of. Because if they told him, or if he had reason to know from other sources, then he would knowingly encounter that. And it says that they would then owe him a duty of care, which they could discharge by warning or taking protective measures. So it would not be an unreasonable risk of harm, for example, as I said, with the asbestos abatement person. He knows what he's getting involved in. Now, gradations of knowledge less than that, it's really a fact question for the jury. And I think that's where the answer lies. Everything that my colleague said to you really should have been said by his trial lawyer based on evidence to the jury in this case. Now, this is not a Prevett case because we don't have worker fault or contractor fault, which is what you had in every case from Prevett to Hooker and McEwen. We don't have a worker hired to encounter the risk. We have a carpenter hired to build scaffolding. But in Prevett, they were hired to carry hot tar. In Toland, they were hired to erect walls. In Camargo, they were hired to run bulldozers. In Hooker, they were hired to extend the retractors on the crane. And in McEwen, they were hired to be on the forklift. Was the risk limited to the operative details? This is an issue that's very important not to get confused on. The answer is yes, it was an operative detail in all of your Prevett cases, but not in this case. In this case, we were operating on hazardous property whose hazard could not be avoided or cured simply by how the scaffolding was erected or not erected. You see, this is a hazard that was installed on the property before we got there, and it was something that we unavoidably had to encounter. So that makes this completely different. And the issues of control, and did they control the workplace, in the traditional Prevett case, that issue has no place here. UNICAL controlled the property sufficiently to install asbestos on it. And that's all the control you need. So I would encourage you, in your opinion, to explain that in some cases a hirer can be liable for negligently creating a risk at a time other than when the worker is exposed to it. Maybe 5 or 10 years ago, they put on the asbestos. Now, they're not on the scene telling the scaffolder how to do it, but the risk is there because they created it.
Mr. Smith, what if I'm asking you to repeat yourself, excuse me, but what is your position on the role of the knowledge of the independent contractor, not Mr. Kinsman, but the independent contractor? If they had access to publications and reports that asbestos was hazardous in this circumstance, how does that affect your case?
You may respond, but your time is otherwise up.
Thank you, Your Honor. It doesn't affect this case, and I'll answer the other case in a second. It doesn't affect this case because there is no evidence of an independent contractor. Unical, which had all the records of who they hired, never put on any proof that the insulators were independent contractors. But in a case that did have an independent contractor in it, it would be apportioned. The fault would be apportioned, and no Privet value would be violated because the hirer could get indemnity. If there wasn't an adequate apportionment, they could get indemnity against a third-party contractor, which is the lack of indemnity is why the Privet rule arose. But here we don't have any problem with that because we have no fault on the part of the employer. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Thank you, Mr. Norris. The matter stands submitted.